¿Qué pasa, Calexico? Welcome back to the podcast. Like always, before we begin, I want to thank a couple of people. I want to thank, first of all, Calexico Brewing Company for allowing me to record today's episode here. I really appreciate your hospitality. I also want to thank all my anchor sponsors. I want to thank my friends Camilo, Jake, Edward Velasquez, John Cabrera from Mercorp, Eddie Lopez from Roots Creative, Norma Sierra Galindo. I want to thank Sergio's Tacos and Hot Dogs, serving the Imperial, San Diego, and Yuma counties with Mexicali style tacos and taquizas for the past 8 years. If you want to schedule an event, make sure to contact Sergio at 760-562-0057 or look for Sergio's Tacos and Hot Dogs on Facebook. And if you guys want to become an anchor sponsor, I'll leave a link in the description below. It really helps the podcast grow. Also, if you are not a subscriber to our YouTube channel, make sure you do so. It really helps us a lot. Today I have a born and raised Broleño. Are you an inductee of the Imperial Valley High School Football Hall of Fame?
Yeah, yes, I am. Luckily enough.
And he was a former Calexico High School teacher. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he still teaches, but he's also an activist who's helping, you know, not only Brole, but the whole Imperial County. My guest today is Mr. Eric Reyes. Thank you for being here today.
No, thank you for the invitation. It's always a pleasure. Un gusto estar en Calexico, como siempre. I love Calexico. Everyone knows it. My Brawley friends get upset with me, but remodo, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah, for sure. Before we get into, you know, all the activist work you do, tell us a little bit about yourself. I know that, you know, you must have an amazing story and you know, growing up in Brole and growing up in the Imperial Valley. I mean, you have a career in teaching, but yet you do so much, you know, after hours, you know, or on the weekends. And I feel that there's something along the way that made you
sure
want to do what you do.
I'll tell you that we grew up in Brawley, but we were a migrant family. I'm the youngest of the family. So by the time I became part of the migrant family, my father had advanced from out of the fields into the packing sheds, which was a better living than, say, working in the fields directly. So he would load and pack melons, watermelons and lettuce and other melons throughout the American Southwest. But we would travel to Central California as a family in the summer when we were out of school. He would work in other areas, including the valley also in the winter. Like now, we're in our harvest season, so mm-hmm. he'd work here in the winter season. But every summer, we would pack up our bags, the whole family. There's my brother, my sister, my mom, myself. And we'd go catch up with our dad and live in the summer so we wouldn't be separated the whole summer. We'd mm-hmm. leave our house in Brawley for the whole summer and then work up. And he worked in Mendota most of the time, California. It's about 40 miles outside of Fresno. And then we would stay most of the time near a small town called Kerman because we had a tia, my dad's sister, Tia Pancha, who was there. So we would have family to hang around with. And we'd rent a garage. We'd rent an empty house. One summer, we actually stayed. They had converted an old drive-in theater and made it into a migrant camp, and we stayed there. Mm-hmm. So we made our place. We slept on the floor. We had, and they had a community restroom only, you know, the drive-in restroom, yeah. Community shower. So, you know, we would make sure we were taken care of there. But, I mean, those type of experiences make you realize, you know, that we need to move ahead as a community. We need to take care of those who are like that, working hard and not receiving what they should. And I'll tell you, we saw atrocities. We saw tragedies. We saw discrimination, racism, labor laws broken, sexual predators. We experienced all that as migrant families. We never experienced it personally, but we saw it. And it made an impression on you. And we stuck together as a nuclear family. Very, very tight. It was a great experience. It still drives everything I do now, those basic things. And more, seeing my tia Pancha, her husband died and left her young and left her with my 8 primos and primas. Wow. Yeah. And she worked in the fields and then she would clean houses at night to help provide for her family, my cousins. And then they would work in the fields, the nearby fields. So I'm going to tell you one experience, never forget. Early 70s. So I was about 8, 9 years old and we were working a grape field right across the street from where my tia was renting a house. And we worked it all day. And just the day before, I had met the owner, the old white man, seemed very nice, gave me a quarter. And then my 8-year-old threw me a quarter. Oh, I was happy. That's a lot of money back then. Back then, yeah. Soda, candies, you know, with a quarter. And we worked it all day, my primos and myself and my brother. And then at the end of the day, we go to his house for payday. He didn't want to pay us.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he didn't pay us. Now he did not pay us. He called the sheriff because we said, hey, we want our money, right? So he calls the sheriff. And the sheriff comes over and says, what's the problem there, Bob? He knew him by name, right?
Yeah.
And he says, well, these Mexicans here are saying they work my fields and I didn't pay them. They're trying to steal from me. I said, I worked that field myself. And we looked at it, and then my tia was there. She goes, you know, I've known this man for 30 years. Why are you doing this now? And he goes, oh, Francis, I've known you. Her name was Frances, right? Mm-hmm. Frances, you're a good woman. You don't need to get involved. Your kids didn't work the fields. They're lying to you. I did it. And then the sheriff says, look, you seem like a nice lady. You know how things run around here. Why don't you get your kids? And my cousins had long hair. This is the 70s. They would say, you know. Yeah. So they had the real long hair, some like almost afros, you know. And they look pretty radical. And they said, get your radical kids out of here before I take them all in. And wow. We were saying, why we worked? Why aren't you going to pay us? He goes, I've known Bob 30 years. He's a man of his word. And if he tells me he didn't, you guys did not work, you did not work.
Wow.
And you need to get off his private property. I'm going to run you all in. So, you know, that's, and we had to leave. He was had already called the other under sheriffs to come and take us all out. So we just moved on out. Nothing we could do. There was no protest we could do. There was no one we could turn to. It was his word was golden. Boy, he was a landowner, too. He was in ag, and ag was the king in the Central Valley. Still is, right? Multi-billion dollar, much like here.
Mm.
And he knew him personally. And he says, he's a good old white man, and we're young radical Mexicans. So yeah. who's he going to believe?
Yeah,
he wasn't going to investigate. Mm. He was going to waste his time with that. So that's one of the ones that indelible lessons that stayed in my mind.
Yeah.
How do we avoid that happening? And you see it happen all the time. It happens here too. There'll be labor contractors, and they're Mexicans too, who will cheat the laborers out of their pay. You know, a lot of times they tell them they're going to work piecemeal. So these guys work real hard. The more they pick, the more they get paid. And at the end of the day, they killed themselves thinking they're going to have a good payday that day, and they pay them hourly. Oh, no, we're just going to pay you hourly. And a lot of times they haven't paid people. We have those stories up and down, and we try. There's a little bit better ways to do it, but you have to follow through and go through the whole thing, and then they get worried about being blackballed and not work again. So
yeah, that's the thing, that you know they're tied to.
Sure,
you know it's yeah. You can't say anything because otherwise you won't eat or you won't have.
So that young experience was is a huge foundation of what I do, and then growing up in Brawley. Brawley is a much different city than Calexico, even though Calexico had a good, robust Anglo population before, from what I know, what I hear. I talked to Victor Carrillo and John Moreno, and knowing who was under city council in the years past, you know, you always had a lot of Anglo people also. It's really dwindled, obviously. Calexico now is overwhelming. Mexicano, Latino, whatever you want to call themselves. See? But I'm saying, Brawley, though, is to this day, even to this day, I know I'm going to get flagged for saying this, but right to this day, there's still a conflict between the powers that be. Back then, it was more noticeable because it used to be a segregated town when it was legal, right? Before they overturned segregation. So you're talking the 30s, the 40s, you know. the railroad tracks were the dividing line. Mexicans live on the east side of town, and the whites live on the west side of town. And even as it started becoming integrated by force, not because they wanted to, but because law says you have to be integrated, right? And they could do jobs, work on jobs. Even then, they had to kind of get across by the time it's nighttime or face issues. And then we, even though we're not of that same generation, there was still a lot of that mindset and that feeling. And a lot of my friends, oh, Eric, you're crazy, you know. I didn't feel any racism or discrimination. Well, you weren't paying attention, or you just let it pass. You know, I felt it real strong. We're the same age. How can you not feel it?
Yeah.
So I used to speak out against it a lot of times. Mm-hmm. They said I'm crazy, you know, and I grew older also. I continue to talk about it, and people didn't like it. They don't like what I say. I'm just saying what I see and what I know, right? I felt it many times, right? So I'm going to tell you, racism is very difficult to deal with. Discrimination is just as bad, if not worse.
Mm.
And I say that because when I started working in Calexico, then I felt the sting of discrimination. are Calexico born and bred, even though their parents or abuelos are from Mexico. They wanted to separate themselves and look down on people, my students, that were coming from Mexicali. Mm-hmm. I taught in the bilingual ed program. That's discrimination. It's not racism. It's just things just as bad as racism. Yeah. You know, they had, I'm sure you heard some of the names they call them. Maybe you did it too. When you're young, you know, we do dumb things. I said some dumb things about people from Mexico too when I was young. Yeah. In Brawley, because we also had that separation issue for a while until you understand, right? They would call my, the los chicalones. The funny ones were chicas tortas, you know. You remember that, right?
You know what? I never.
No?
Yeah, I probably did. Yeah,
but chicalones was the. Remember, yeah. Los chicalones, mm-hmm. You know, they make fun of donde vienes, del pueblo nuevo, de la baja, you know, or el ferrocarril. They would make fun of what neighborhood they were from, you know. That's discrimination. It hurts. It hurts those. And it would hurt those. They tenían mucho coraje. Remember, there would be a lot of fights on campus.
Yeah.
A lot of time it was those.
The Calesianos and
the Calesianos versus los chicalones, right? Yeah. And what are you looking at? What are they fighting over? You know, over who owns what? And usually it was lower income Calesianos. A lot of them lived in projects, you know, government subsidies. Yeah, and it was a lot of them. What are they fighting about? It's not so much that they had so much hate and discrimination against gente de Mexicali. It's they weren't happy with their own lives and the things they were seeing as well. And they felt cheated, maybe, and they felt that they weren't being given a sin, and they didn't want no one else taking that little sliver of what, instead of trying to go for something higher, they're protecting a little small piece. And the same thing happened in Raleigh. They integrated, we had such racial problems, they thought that they had to integrate the elementary schools, and they would bus kids from the west side of Raleigh to the east side of Raleigh, so they would get, at the young age, from kindergarten to third, they would go. Everyone would go to school on the east side. We had two schools, elementary schools, right? And then they would bus the older kids from the east side, fourth through sixth, would be bused to the west side. So they would be together. And by the time you get to junior high, they already know each other. High school, there's less racial issues. But the biggest issue was still poorer, lower economic students against other poor, lower economic students, people from government camp, the campo, they called it on the west side, versus the proyectos, the people in the government projects on the east side. They were still in conflict.
Yeah.
And why? Again, this feeling of not being treated the same, this feeling of others taking something from them as theirs, and they grow into adults and they fight over territory that's not even theirs, right? And we had a really bad gang problem and shootings. And then Calexico went through the same thing with La Garra and
La 101.
La 101, right? I remember the names. So they went through the same issues here. And what are they fighting for? You know, it's not even their land. They live in government projects.
Yeah.
Not that I'm making fun of them. I'm saying the idea is you're adults. I go, what are they fighting? Who controls, you know, this? And they're going to have to be booted out. They can't live there forever. Mm-hmm. It's not theirs. But it's this issue that people have, and they want to claim something for themselves because they have so little, and they don't want no one trying to take that from them.
Do you think that in the 80s, 90s, that culture of, you know, Chicano and the lowriders and the cholos, for a while, I felt, you know, because I grew up in the 90s here in Calexico. I got here in 90, and, you know, for a while, you know, I live in the projects.
Yeah.
And I remember watching Blood and Blood Out, American Me.
Right, they were glorifying. It was a form of glorifying that lifestyle, not really teaching.
Mm-hmm.
American Me more was teaching, but I'm saying a lot of these other ones, the young generation took it as, wow, that's awesome. Mm-hmm. I want to be like that. The message wasn't that. It was telling you reality. At the end, how many of them died or were drug addicts or had horrible things happen? That was the message, but they didn't see that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, they just saw, oh, look, we're on TV or, you know.
Right.
We're in a movie. How do you compare it now to, you know, the narco stories or the narco music and movies and shows that we have now? Like, do you see any resemblance?
No, definitely. And it's promoting the stereotype of a raza. And this is all of us together. No separation here, right? Because drug trafficking, human trafficking has people on both sides doing it, right? And it's a network of people who are predators trying to earn a dollar off of someone else's misery, right? Anybody that sells drugs and seeing the misery and you're happy with yourself earning that money of causing those horrible tragedies and addictions and everything that comes with it, you should be ashamed of yourself, mm-hmm. right? But what drives people is profit money, right? Profiteering is the same thing as these pharmaceutical companies that charge way more than they should here. And they people come to buy the same pharmacies in Mexico, bien barato, in Canada, very cheap. Same thing, how you're causing people to make choices in their lives over things. But yeah, it's driving that same stereotype of before, that we as raza are inferior, not as good as mainstream white America. And this is a perfect example of it. And unfortunately, a lot of our own raza glorify that. They think that's power. You know, you can have as much money as you want, but it's not power. You know, that's power in that circle of trafficking, I guess. And, you know, if that's what you consider power, I understand. But I'm saying all it does is drive home the point to those who don't like us of what we are, you know. Even though we have great examples that we're doctors, we're teachers, we're humanitarians, we're everything. Mm-hmm. Yet, who will people remember? You know, los traficantes and everything, the negative part of what we do as a raza. And that every raza has negatives,
yeah.
But they seem to promote ours. And then our own people, we like to glorify that for some reason. Yeah. You know, it's not religion, but if you're religious in Catholicism, they have a lot of patron saints, that santos.
Mm-hmm.
They even have a santo now for narcotraficantes. I mean, how could that be part of any organized religion? How are we promoting that, right? Mm-hmm.
But he's just somebody that he's not
sanctioned, right?
Yeah, by the church.
Right,
just somebody that.
But it came from that culture of promoting la idea that's something positive. Well, narcotraficante is not a positive influence for our community.
Mm.
Makes some people filthy rich, but it's not a positive influence overall for our community.
Mm. And yeah, and it's, I feel that, you know, it's like you said, you're glorifying it, and a lot of kids see it as something
right.
to look up to or strive to be, you know.
Right.
And it's sad. It's kind of sad because, like you said, like even like when we talk about, you know, American Me, Mama, Blood and Blood Out, you know, at the end story, you know, they end up either in prison or dead. And,
right.
You know, they're not seeing that.
And the destruction they left behind also.
Yeah.
That goes on for sometimes generations, right?
Mm.
And we've seen that. I've seen it here in Calexico, seen it in Raleigh, I've seen it wherever I've gone. And I don't understand it. I was lucky to have a rock solid family foundation. And then I was lucky enough not to make those wrong choices. Because you can come from a great family and still make poor choices, right? And I've seen that also. So I was able to do that. Part of it was my conscience. Part of it was my foundation. Part of it was my goal of I wanted to be educated, because that was from our movement. My parents didn't even go to high school.
Mm-hmm.
They graduated eighth grade at Miguel Hidalgo School on the east side of Raleigh. That was usually the high point for most Mexicanos in the 40s, because from there they had to go work to help support the family. But from both of my parents did that. Cesar Chavez, who went through 60 elementary schools, also stayed long enough in Raleigh, about 2 years, I think, or 3 years, that he graduated also eighth grade from Miguel Hidalgo School. and that movement also told us we need to strive to do better for ourselves. Farm working is a very honorable, dignified work, but we don't have to stay there. We don't have to be in a trajectory that doesn't advance me, my children, and others. We can do more if we want to, so we so desire. Mm-hmm. And that's what it, and that was our parents worked so hard to make sure we had that opportunity. Now it was up to us to take advantage of it, but individually, but I'm saying that was the goal. So that was my goal. I didn't want to let them down. I wanted to get an education, and I wanted to provide something for my children in the future as well.
So your parents, you know, your roots in Bali are like deep, because your parents are from Raleigh.
Yeah, not only that, they were born in Raleigh. My abuelos came across in the early parts of the Mexican Revolution. They opened up. There wasn't even no border. I don't know if you knew that during the 1910s, when the Mexican Revolution started, the Emiliano Zapata, Pancho Villa, Madero, Huerta, all those, Obregón.
Mm-hmm.
There was a revolution going on in Mexico. And here in California, they had just started opening Imperial Valley. They needed hard labor, like always. And where did they turn to? They turned to Mexico for hard labor. The open borders, if you could come work, and they had to dig the ditches of that idea along with the Chinese and along with the African Americans, right? And others that came to work, but they had to, it was not, we didn't have tractors back then, right? Big tractors. So a lot of manual labor to do all this canal works that we did in the Imperial Irrigation District, this now Imperial Irrigation District. Then it was, why was water brought to the Imperial Valley? And it wasn't brought to the early 1900s to build an agricultural area. So what do you need then? You need a field laborer. So here you go. Working supply, which we still count on Mexico, Mexicali, Imperial Valley is a almost 3 billion, 2.8 billion this past year, almost $3 billion, revenue stream for our county. And who is our labor force? Wake up and come at 12, 1, 2 in the morning, and you're going to see 10 to 20,000 people crossing from Mexicali to work legally here in the United States every day. This is their harvest season. This is the time they make them as much money as they can to provide for their families. It's a hard work.
Yeah.
And what are we doing? We're taking advantage of a cheap labor force, not going to complain about conditions, and they're going to work hard to make other people very rich. And it's true. They become very rich. I mean, and more power to them. But we also want to point out they should be respected and given as many opportunities as possible.
Yeah,
as well.
For sure. So you mentioned your parents. They really wanted you to go to school. Something that they
yeah, because they both wanted. They told me they wished they had gone to high school at least. But their parents basically told them, well, you know,
we need help.
You need to help the family, or you need to move out on your own. So they helped the family. And then this is the funny part. My father, they were much poorer than my mother's family. My mother's family, we were fortunate to have my grandfather, Ramon Montoya. He was actually a professional boxer, and he was pretty successful in the 1920s and 30s. So he built a little foundation of money and bought homes and was able to, and then he had businesses after that. So a little bit better, he had a established himself financially much better than, say, my familia Reyes, my dad's family. And they were true migrants. I mean, they didn't even have a home. My father was born, my mom would always make fun of him because he was born in a tent.
Wow.
Born in a tent where the family lived outside of Brawley next to a ditch bank. And my mom would make fun of him. Well, at least I was born in my house. Because back then, the doctor would go to the house on the East Side con los Mexicanos, and they wouldn't, either a midwife or the doctor. My mother actually had a doctor, she said. She was one of the few that had a doctor, because the boxer, he was still in his prime at that time. In 1927, she was born. He was able to afford the doctor to come to the house. Otherwise, they would have midwives come. Mm-hmm. He actually had a house in Brawley already.
Parteras.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's becoming popular again. I don't know if you noticed that.
But yeah, they call them midwives, or they have another name.
Yeah, they have another name.
It's like I can't remember what it was. I was talking to with my friend the other day. But yeah, you know, it's a partera. Like if you narrow it down, it's.
So my dad's goal was to have a house where we could live as a family, not a tent, you know, and pick up every few weeks and move, and two, for us to go to school that they didn't have, and. He went to so many schools, just like Cesar Chavez, that by the time he was able to actually go to class enough and graduate, he was almost 17 years old. So almost 17 to about 7 months later, so he was almost 17. At 7 months later, after graduating eighth grade, at 17 and a half, he was drafted into World War II. And that was very common.
Dang.
Yeah, but that was like graduating high school. It was a big thing, graduating eighth grade. And it was segregated, so the school, Miguel Hidalgo School, was from kindergarten to eighth in those days.
Okay.
There was no junior high. So, and people could graduate there and then go to high school, which many did later, but I'm saying in those days it was very rare. College was even rarer for people of that era. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very difficult. So that was one of their main goals, was to offer us the opportunity at least to become, go to college, become professionals in other fields. And my sister, Barbara Reyes Loera, married to the sheriff of Imperial County.
She was my third
degree teacher. She was a teacher at Kennedy Gardens.
Yeah, she was my third degree teacher.
Yeah, there you go.
She was the first teacher I had here in Calexico, so I'll never forget her.
At Kennedy Gardens or at Rockwood?
Kennedy Gardens.
Okay.
And she was the nicest teacher I've
Yeah, my sister.
I mean, not that I ever had, but I remember her... you know, like I said, like she was my first teacher here, and like she was super nice. And I would come back to Kennedy even after graduating from high school, and she would recognize me. I don't know if she would recognize me now, but I think I had more hair back then.
We all did.
But yeah, like, yeah, wow, I didn't know she was your sister.
Yeah, yeah. And when I started working in Calexico, years after she's 10 years older than me, in Calexico, and I would say, oh, she's my sister. I go, what? There's no way, you guys are so different, right? Yeah. That's how it is in dynamics of family, you know? Yeah.
Like she's super quiet.
Yeah. Right? Super nice. You're not so nice, Eric.
I didn't say that. But no, I mean, the
She was one of the first teachers of when they opened Kennedy Gardens. They took her, the principal that took her, because she, in a group, he picked his teachers, and she was one of them.
Wow.
And she finished her career at Kennedy Gardens. Yeah, yeah. Had a long career there, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I got here in 90, and she was a teacher then, and I think she was there before I got there. Mm-hmm. And she didn't retire that long ago, did she?
Well, it's been a while now, about 7-8 years, mm-hmm. I think, yeah.
But, and then, yeah, her husband is...
the sheriff, Florida, huh? First Mexican-American sheriff of Imperial County. We're really proud of that as well in our history, so...
So what was, for you, what was it going to school in Brawley? You said that, you know, even today there's still that.
Yeah, there was always these tensions. And the thing is, some people will ignore it, so they don't want to get engaged in it. They don't want to be part of it, you know. And other people, they can observe it and understand it also. So yeah, there was a lot of these issues. You know, I would tell people, I still tell people about it, and they kind of say, you're crazy. You know, you're just a racist yourself. Well, sure, I might be. I'm not going to say I'm not, right? We all have a touch of racism somewhere in ourselves. it's just, are we going to act on it overtly and be racist and overly harsh on people? No, I try not to, but other people, they do it. And it could be an offhand remark. You know, it could be some other people think it's a joke, but a lot of times they're telling the truth of their feelings and how they feel about it.
And someone. I think for Mexican culture, you know, we have this, And I don't think it's, you know, us being racist. It's just, you know, how we kind of like were brought up. I mean, I try not to use it, but, you know, our parents do, where it's like, oh, el chinito. Oh,
sí, claro. Descriptive. Yeah. We're like that. It's part of our cultura. Right?
Yeah. And it's not, like you said, it's not that we're being racist. It's just, you know, that we're, that's how we were, not taught, but like, oh, you know, el vecino del chinito or whatever, you know, but, and it's, that's how we call them, and nothing, we're not doing it in an evil way or a bad way, you know.
Yeah, but you hear remarks like, you know, oh, look at those people. Well, what exactly is those people? I'm one of those people. Yeah. I see a group of Mexicanos, and what's the difference between me and them? The difference is you know me, right? So they don't consider me like that.
One of those.
But that's an insult. It's an insult in general. And they, but you're not like them. I've heard that from many people. Sure I am. And sometimes I want you to explain to me. And they, you don't misunderstood. No, I think I understood completely. And it catches them, but I'd like to know. I'm always trying to learn also. I think things evolve, you know. You're talking about how... You know, how do you describe yourself? Well, it's up to you, but look at all the terms and labels. They evolve. So do people's thinking. Right now, what's the big term? Latinx. Latinos. More power to them. That's how they want to self-identify, right? So it evolves and people's thinking evolves. So you're not one of those people if you're not speak only Spanish and are from Mexico, maybe that's what they meant. Well, it didn't come across that way. It was like those people, like they're down. I'm way better than them. But you're not like them. I go, okay, but I am Mexican. So what are you trying to say exactly? Yeah.
So what do you consider yourself? Huh? Like if you had to pick, what would be your label, I guess?
Remember, like when I used to teach Chicano studies, it's completely up to you, and it could be up to that moment how you feel yourself being at that time. There are times when I'm definitely a Chicano because I'm an activist and I get out there and I wanna raise the voice of Chicanos, Mexicanos to make sure they are being heard. And there's times I'm Mexican American. There's times I'm Mexicano. I can say, oh, soy Mexicano because I wanna be Mexicano at that time, right? Yeah. I wasn't born in Mexico, but I me siento cultura Mexicano, and I have a deep love of the culture. I completely disrespect what has happened in Mexico as a nation, as a government that has led the nation to be where it's at with such beautiful people, but the people are not to blame. The culture is beautiful and the people are humble and can do so much better than what's being offered to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's, you know, now that you mention all those, you know, how it depends on, you know,
on
the situation.
Yeah.
Because yeah, like, you know, sometimes we're like, when they ask you, what are you? Well, I'm Mexican, but you know, I'm Mexican American cause I live in America. But Chicano, I think, Sunday mornings when my wife sends me for the tortillas, I'll put some oldies and I feel Chicano.
There you go.
So, yeah, it's
true. You have
true.
The essence of it. There you
yeah,
go.
Yeah, it's true.
You should have taken my class. You'd be way ahead.
Wow,
now you'd be
crazy.
Great, just like Emilio. Emilio Davila.
Emilio, shout out to Emilio and Turi Encinas. We were talking
Turi
about
Encinas,
you guys.
Yeah, Emilio Davila, the El Venado, Baile del Venado.
and not the... There's a
yeah, not that one.
Yeah.
Pero de los yaquis.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, and you know, you're talking about, you know, the Mexican culture and you know, the country of Mexico. You know, even in Mexico, there's racism against their own people.
Oh, definitely. You know, I used to tell this story all the time to my students when I work with them. I said, think about this. I said, when someone is born... And they call, nació, you know, so-and-so, el hijo o hija de...
Fulanito.
De mi hija o mi hijo. And then, what's the first thing the older Mexicanos want to know? ¿Está prieto o está güerito? What? They don't want to know if they have 10 fingers and toes.
Y tal, is he healthy?
Yeah. Is he healthy? ¿Qué color es? Yeah. That's what they want to know. Because
yeah.
Because obviously they prefer lighter skin Mexicanos to darker skin Mexicanos. Yeah. How sad, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't have nothing to do with the person. This is since they're born. Yeah. And we have nicknames for people who are dark. La Prieta, La Negra, El Negro, yeah. Right? El Chamuco, Chamuco.
It's funny because I remember the first time I introduced my wife to my family from Michoacán. They came down for Christmas. And my wife's like, güerita, Joana Reyes is my norm. Mm-hmm. They call her Tapenga in high school.
Mm-hmm.
So I introduced them. And at this time, my tío from Mexico, well, he was my dad's tío. So he was much older. And he's like, mejorando la familia.
Porque estaba güerita, you see?
And my tía, that's
not
a little
even
bit,
knowing her, yeah. Knowing if she's a good person, which she probably is, but I'm just saying.
And my tía, who's a little bit darker, she got really upset because she's like, what the fuck? What about me?
Okay.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's funny that, yeah, you know, that's one of the first things that we...
They would hear in my family.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. And my mom would always say, a ti te fue bien, mijo, porque estás güerito, you know? Pero tu hermano... Maxi.
Yeah.
And I still joke with him about that. You know, I was her favorite because I was güerito, not for any other reason.
I thought because you were the baby.
Yeah, also. I said, had everything going for me.
So what was high school for, like, you play football and then
yeah,
you kind of use that as a
football, baseball. When I was younger, I played everything. And then as I got older into high school, I focused on football and baseball. I was really successful in both. And, I had a great childhood that I was able to play, all sports there. Like I said, our parents wanted to make sure we had an opportunity to do everything. They didn't. So. I was at, and then I lived kitty corner to Hina. It's called Hinojosa Park now. At that time, it was Longfellow Park, named after the author. And pásale. So I was in the park almost every day, just like all the neighborhood kids were in those days. And we play sports year round because the weather was, well, except in the summer, right? But I'm saying, and we weren't here in the summer, but almost the rest of the year, school year, we're playing sports. And some of it was organized, Little League and so on. And other times, we're just playing in the
backyard,
park.
Yeah.
Pick up baseball, pick up football, pick up basketball. And we're playing basketball, all these sports all year round. And I was lucky, as I said, just walked across the corner. And we felt safe, even though there was issues going around us. But in the park, it was kind of a sanctuary because there were young kids always there. So there weren't those. Not like now, you know, you have to worry a little bit more. There's a lot less respect for even areas that you wouldn't think are not safe anymore, right? There's a lot of predators out there now that we didn't see as bad as before. Maybe they were, but for some reason, wasn't as prevalent as today. You know, the sexual predators and the drug addicts and the homeless that have mal intentions. There's some that are not well and they have bad intentions, right? So we kind of shield our children from that. But when we were there, we were out there all the time.
Yeah, I remember growing up here in Calexico, you know, I used to walk everywhere by myself sometimes. Sure. Rode bikes, you know, all across Calexico. But yeah, I feel that, you know, there were those kinds of people, but I think like now with the internet and we hear more about it.
We hear more about it. But you know, we didn't even lock our door. I didn't have a key to my house. I go to school and I walk home, door would be open if my parents were working. Just a different era, different time, different mindset.
So you went to IVC and then you went to...
Yeah, I went to IVC. I played 1 year of football and that's it. And then 2 years of baseball. And then I moved on to Seattle University. I had a couple of guys from Raleigh that were there, the Carter brothers, the two black kids from Raleigh were great athletes in all sports also. And we were very close, played ball since we were young and in the park. And they recruited me to go with them, you know, make their team goals. And we had a really good time there. And I was able to get my degree. They both graduated from there as well. So very proud of them as well. And I came back. I had other plans, but my father became ill with cancer. So I had to drop out of university. Mm-hmm. So I didn't finish right away. I dropped out, came to be with him in his last months. And then I returned later to finish my degree. Then I came back to be with my mother for a while. And then started a family later and then teaching. And
your dad passed away fairly young then.
Yeah, 60 years old. Okay. He never drank or smoked. I always tell people, you know, he never drank or smoked, but he lived near fields all his life. Pesticides were unregulated. Nowadays, they don't even allow the U.S. to use DDE and DDT that are banned now. And back then it was prevalent and they would be out in the open where people, and people live in the camps in those days. It was a whole different world. And then they would spray it on them almost practically, you know, Cesar Chavez and other people that fought for farm worker rights changed those laws. So they wouldn't be in those type of conditions and they wouldn't spray while they're working. But it took a long time for people to understand the impact that they had. Why? Profiteering again. So profiteering is what makes America a great capitalist nation. It's also why we have so many problems as well, because we'll do anything to make that dollar and don't care about those who are impacted by you making that dollar. Yeah, yeah, that's part of our mantra. And people will disagree with me, and that's fine. You know, I have always said, I have my bias and prejudice. So do you. Mm-hmm. If you're making tons of money, you don't want to pay taxes. You don't like tax increases, right? But if you understand that you work and we have a social network that can take care of my mother as she got, she just recently passed away, but 93 years old, doesn't financially ruin me, my sister and my brother, because she worked all her life, she deserves that as well. Mm-hmm. And where does that come from? It comes from the taxpayer. Why not? I don't see the issue with it. And we should do more for people like that as well.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
So you came back, and then when did you start teaching here?
1989 at Calexico High School. And it's a really funny story. I don't know if you knew the counselor, Rene Rendon.
Yeah.
Mr. Rendon, mm-hmm. He was on the interview committee. This is the funny part, because the principal was Garth Eisen. And he was actually my principal when I was in elementary school as a student, sixth grade. Yeah, so he remembered me. And he called me, hey, I started subbing. He goes, hey, there's a job opening at Calexico High School. Would you be interested? Sure, I'll go interview. So I go to the interview, and then we interview, and Rendon is on the interview panel. Became a very good friend of mine to this day. Whenever, it's the first time he had met me, though, and then afterwards, hey, Reyes, yeah, I want to ask you a question. Yeah, you're from Eastside Brawley? I go, yeah, yeah. What are you, a baseball player or a musician? He goes, because everybody I know from Eastside Brawley is a baseball player or a musician. I said, I'm a baseball player first, and I want to be a musician.
I want to be.
Yeah. All these other guys that he knew, Richard Diaz, Armando Padilla, they were all musicians and baseball players. You know, so, it was something that we had in our culture, the Mexican culture. But that was a very Chicano thing to be in a band and play oldies, like you said, and play some rancheras. Of course, the old folks, you know, make them happy. But do your rock and roll and your oldies and stuff. That was the American side of us, right?
So what did you start teaching here in Calexico? What subject were you teaching?
When I first started, it was world history and U.S. history. Mm-hmm. Then I went on to government. And then later, when they started offering more electives, I was able to institute Chicano studies with Dr. Gilbert Mendez, was our resource teacher who helped me facilitate. And then we had Latin American theater with Mr. Gaitan, and then we had with Mr. Hodge, he had
drama,
which he incorporated a lot of Mexican American Chicano literature and plays into it. We all did Luis Valdez. I was just talking about this when I saw that picture of Turi Encinas. One time we
the picture.
And Espiro. We held a night of plays. We all did a Luis Valdez play. So each Luis Gaitan, myself, and Bill Hodge, in our class, Latin American Theater, mm-hmm. Chicano Studies, and Drama, we all picked a different Luis Valdez play. And Turi was the lead actor in each one. He always wanted to be an actor. That was his goal in life, mm-hmm. right? And he was very good at high school level, right? Not way above everybody, but he was serious about it.
Yeah.
He had obvious talent and charisma. To this day, he has charisma, right? Mm-hmm. He's very likable, very, very charismatic. You like him, you know, he'll make you laugh. He'll look at you. You know, you like the guy, right?
Yeah.
And he was the lead actor in every single play that we did that night, a whole night of plays. And it was great. It was a night of chicanismo.
I was going to do one of them. What was it? Because Hodge did one was Moctezuma, and then he had like a messenger or something, some guy that brought the message to. I remember I was playing that part, but I didn't get it. Bill Hodge wanted me to do like a dumbed down character of that. So somebody else got it. I remember who got it.
Emilio used to do the plays also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Emilio Davila is my good, really good friend.
Yeah.
So when you started teaching Chicano studies, was it something that you kind of already wanted to do? Or?
Oh, yeah. I used to interject a little bit of Chicano history into U.S. history. Mm. It wasn't really a big part of the curriculum, but having it being such a big part of my life and understanding the movement of Cesar Chavez and the movement of Mexicanos in U.S. Trying to put a foothold and be respected just like any other American, I thought it was important to. So I was always interject where I could in the curriculum. Some background info that we were here also. Mexicans have been here forever in the U.S., right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, this used to be the Mexico, right? Yeah. So it's not like we're new to the United States,
yeah.
Even though people say that, right? Yes, we have immigrants, obviously, but we were also here. Mm-hmm. We're part of U.S. history, regardless of American Southwest. Yeah. And so then they started offering different classes, and we were able to offer more electives, and we picked up Chicano studies, which is very common in the university, right? A lot of kids go and they're very Americanized when they're here in the U.S. schools, Mexicano Americanos, you know, because they're not really
exposed to
that type of teaching. And then their parents, a lot of times, they don't have the time to talk, or they think it's going to hurt them to become radicalized and think about themselves in these ways. So they also don't expose them to it. And then,
yeah, do you think that most parents that are like first or like parents that have first generation immigrants or kids that were born here, do you think they try to get them to assimilate more to the country and the culture here?
Yeah, because they've been told that's the way to get hit, but it's there's room for both. You know, looking now, if you look at education, the push is for dual immersion to learn Spanish and English since they're young, because that's when you improve your language. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about non-Spanish speaking people. They're exposing them now to Spanish. Why? Because there's going to be greater opportunity, economic opportunity, if you're in a border region, to the Mexican, or not just Mexican, but all Latinos. Spanish speaking community is exploding throughout the United States, right? And learning more than one language has been proven through scientific study expands the mind more than learning just one language at a time. And it's much easier to pick up language when your brain is young and fresh and absorbing everything than when you're already set in ways. In Europe, they basically know 5-6 languages because it's the economy and everything is interjected.
They're more connected with other countries.
Sure.
Yeah, because right here we have Mexico and Canada, which is, you know, Canada, although they speak French, you know, English, they also speak English. So we don't have that need to communicate other languages.
Right.
Because I remember asking this to somebody that's kind of like similar to me, where like we were first generation here, and I'm like, why do you think your parents never really spend that time, you know, teaching you our culture, teaching you about you know the Mexican culture or the history? And he's like, his answer was that they were too busy, you know, with work and
trying to survive, trying to raise them.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of it. Mm-hmm. I think the other subconsciously, they really do believe that they'll advance more if they don't have that as albatross or carry.
Yeah, like it's bringing you down. Like
yeah, a rock on your back. Mm-hmm. They really feel that way. Unfortunately, I think there's more than enough room to be proud of your roots, su cultura. I do it all the time. Viva la raza. People came, oh, la raza guy. And probably some people call me la raza guy because they say, viva la raza. What's wrong with that? Raza means gente. Yeah. It doesn't mean a race. You know, it's not translated directly. And I'm talking about people that think like me, that act like me and believe in things like I do, like equal opportunity. That's my raza. Doesn't have to be, you don't have to be Mexican to be my raza.
Yeah.
You know, I've worked with a lot of good people who are not Mexican, who are way better than a lot of Mexicanos I know, because there's good and bad, because they believe in equality and offering opportunities, and they believe in sharing their knowledge and sharing their network of knowledge and people that they know. And that's what we all need to do, kind of share. When we need to pick people up, not knock them down.
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't do that. They won't help someone up.
And, you know, talking about...
Que aprenda él mismo, él solo, you know, no?
Para que aprendas.
Yeah.
That way you learn, como decía George Lopez.
George Lopez.
You know, talking about equality, you know, you're part of a lot of committees and like part of Comité Cívico del Valle. You're part of the redistricting committee. Tell us a little bit about some of the committees you're part of. Yeah. And
I was on the Imperial County Redistricting Committee, and I'm on the Imperial Valley College Redistricting Committee currently. They didn't have an advisory committee for the Imperial Irrigation District, but I'm active on that redistricting committee as well. And I'm on the Lithium Valley Lithium Ordinance for the county talks and dialogue, making sure that we have an opportunity to let the county know what the residents and the valley should be receiving from it's going to be a multi-billion dollar investment and development, and we need to get our fair share as a community also. And I'm a constant public comment and during action item, agenda items speaker on issues that impact our community. I've been doing it for a long time, and I tried to take a break for a while, and I was seeing a new generation that was getting involved. But I saw that there was still a need for a voice like mine. Mine is kind of unique, kind of different. I've always told people, oh, you think you're a leader? I said, you know what? I am a leader. I'm going to tell you why. I'm a leader of one. That movement is mine and mine alone. I don't need anybody else to really say, you know, this is a movement that I look at the people with me. No, I do it by myself. I'm very proud of that. And then if I can align with people to make it stronger, I will. Comité Cívico, those IV Equity and Justice from here in Calexico. Mm-hmm. Calexico needs change. We work on common things that we believe are important for all of us. We don't band together for everything because we don't agree on everything. And that's the way it should be. But I am a leader, I tell them. Mm-hmm. And they get me, oh, you think you're a leader? I go, yeah, I lead myself. I think if more people were to lead themselves and not let them others tell them what is good for them, our county would be better, our country would be better, and we ourselves would be better.
You know, you make a good point, and when it comes to, you know, you align with people when there's, you know,
issues that we believe in, sure.
But there's sometimes, you know, recently, it happened to me recently where one of these local groups wanted me to kind of like back them up, help them out, spread the word on something, and that's something that I didn't really feel comfortable with. So I said, you know what, I think I'll pass on this one. And I kind of like got a, you know, somebody that tried to intimidate me into doing it. I'm like, you know what, I'm a grown ass man, you know,
right.
You're not going to tell me what to do. So, you know, and I feel that it's not only here, but it happens everywhere.
No,
like
it happens everywhere.
When you don't align with everything they say or do. They kind of want to, like, you know, this cancel culture or this, oh, I'm not going to support you anymore. I'm going to, you know, blackball you on this. You know, what are your thoughts on? Or because it feels like there's a big a new generation of kids. I call them kids because, you know, they're younger than me.
Right. Imagine what I call them.
Babies.
No, it's good.
But I mean, which is good. I feel that, you know, as somebody that works, you know, you work in education, I work in education, we always say, you know, the kids, the youth is the future. So
they are the future. Right?
So now that they're there, you know, speaking their voice, sometimes we don't, there's a lot of adults that you know, are trying to quiet them down. So I kind of support them. And when it comes to, like you say, issues that I align with, but when I don't align with, they kind of like want to blackball me. And I'm like, what do you think when they kind of want to do that to other people?
They are contradicting. I'm going to say it happens to me all the time. And I tell them this, they are contradicting the very premise of why they started, of creating a new voice that's independent of how others how others think that they feel has not allowed the community to progress or is not listening to understanding the needs and wants of the youth. Okay, so I can respect that. I respect that 100%. I think there's a really IV Equity and Justice have done a great job of organizing young educated minds from Calexico and people who live outside the valley. Mm-hmm. I'm on some of their Zoom meetings. When there's an issue that I want to discuss with them, I join them as well. Mm-hmm. You know, Luis and Daniela Flores, yeah. The brother and sister act. I mean, they're really, really positive forces. And I've seen it at Calexico and Exchange. I've seen it with Raul Ureña, your councilman, you know, who's a friend of mine. I was just with him last night. Like, I'm not going to support everything Raul does. I'm not going to support everything Ivy Equity Justice does. I won't support everything Calexico Needs Change does. I won't not support everything Comité Cívico does, our roots or us. And they will not support everything I do for the reason that we are independent. We are independent minds. We have our own agendas, and you have to understand them. There's always an agenda, no matter what. I have no agenda. They're lying to. Everyone carries an agenda with them when they go into wherever they're going. Uh-huh. You know, they don't form it, their ideas as it goes. I mean, they have a preconceived idea of things they're going to do, and then they can adjust. But if they do not allow individuals to make that choice of whether to support or not support, they are contradicting their own desire to be a larger voice. They are also being narrow-minded, just like as others are. Mm-hmm. They are also denying the fact that they are not always right. And there's things that you can improve on. And they should respect your decision. And I hope you told them, but don't worry, on other things that I do agree on, I'll support you. Mm-hmm. They should respect that and not try to bully you or shame you or say, well, you're wrong. Well, they can try and dialogue with you in a respectful way to try to maybe convince you that's their right also. And you have the right to say, well, you know, I don't want to hear about it right now. Mm-hmm. Or you can say, okay, listen, I'll listen. Doesn't mean I'm going to change my mind.
Yeah.
So that's what I have to say about it, that they need to be respectful of those they partner with, not try to force them to do things. Because when you force someone, it's just not going to come out the way you want.
Yeah. And the voice
is not going to be as strong.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, what happened with me was like, you know, just talking to the person, I still follow and support the organization they're part of,
sure.
But you know, just like you know, I just I was like, you know what, that's it. You know, I'll just do whatever I want with the organization and with them, and you know, you're just not gonna be part of my group friends. So it's like, yeah, that's
so who loses though? The community loses,
mm-hmm.
because if you're together on things later that you do want to work on that are important mm-hmm. to you and the organization. Mm-hmm. That makes it stronger, you know?
So. Yeah, no, and I feel that, you know, because there's something that me and this person still do that, you know, I still work with, that doesn't put a line, you know, you know, I'm still like, yeah, if I agree with something that we're doing in this community that we're part of, you know, support him, you know, but, you know, I put this block where, like, you know, I'm not going to let you try to, you know, bully me into doing something that I'm not. But I'll support you in other things. So.
No, sure. I think that's the right approach. But I hope they reflect and analyze on what they're doing. If they heard you, tell them that.
I hope so.
Yeah,
but
we all need to be. If we want to grow, we have to respect each other. That's why we have groups, because they feel there isn't enough respect for the voice and agenda that we represent. Mm. That's why I do what I do. I know for sure farm workers are not respected as they should be. Gente that live in trailer parks, like we were just out in where they had the fire. I mean, they're not being given the proper service. They're not being treated equally by the services that are available. And that's my agenda, to make sure I can at least represent a voice for them as I try to get them engaged. Hardest thing to do. I got a friend here, Danny Santian.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, big Danny Raza, right?
Sí, yeah.
From Brawley.
He was my basketball coach.
Yeah, you know, he says, you know, Eric, I got the hardest job to do. He goes, get La Raza involved in politics and their community. And he's correct. You know, he's older than me, but he's one of the guys that I always work with because we believe in certain things together. And he is very true. And I see it now as I get older. It's so hard, so hard. And then the new generation, there's a good pocket of well-educated activists who are grounded in social beliefs as we are, social justice. And then there's another generation, young, same age and so on, that are very well grounded in the capitalistic system and making the most for themselves and not really caring about others. Hey, more power to them, but we need to work with everyone to make sure we can still deliver what needs to be delivered to the community. Mm-hmm. And if they become the power brokers as the past power brokers, oh, well, shoot, we really need to make sure they understand that this is why you need to do these things.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's this, like this balance, right? You gotta, you know, still keep, you know, keep jobs here. Cause I mean, if somebody gets like, screw this, I'm not gonna deal with this, you know, they just send the, cause water is a big issue here in the valley. So they can, you know, stop farming and, you know, we are left out of jobs and that income. So you know, there's gotta be a balance as to, like I said, like if there's somebody, this new group of generation, new generation that's wanna be, you know, that capitalist group. And this social justice group, you know, they gotta kind of like work hand in hand and make them understand the.
Sure, there has to be a working middle ground where, because there's opportunities for everyone. We want to make sure we deliver to those who aren't having that same opportunity. That's always been our goal. And how do we do that though? With civic engagement, and that is our weak spot in Imperial County. There's another guy who came from out of town. He's from Brawley, became a multi-millionaire, not billionaire, almost a billionaire. He says. He's very rich. He wanted to come in and do a regional airport out by Hopeville. But he wanted exclusive rights where he thought he could come in with money and get this all done. And then when he didn't get his way, he said, well, you know, Imperial County is the most apathetic county because people were so scared of committing to some ideas that scare them. And it's true. They just kind of just shy away and it no longer becomes a project. And we have done that. We've just shied away from so many opportunities. We got to take the opportunities and let it go as far as it can where we can see how it's going to develop, not write it off originally. Like you said, there has to be a balance. Mm. If someone is coming and they want, we have a long history of people coming, getting special treatment and not delivering. Well, we didn't really look at the fine print. We need to do a better job of looking at the fine print. Doesn't mean because of that past experience, we're going to turn everybody away. Because then we all lose again.
You mentioned, you know, getting, you know, the community involved. I think Calexico, I mean, I don't know about other cities, but I kind of focused a lot on Calexico because I obviously live
there. Sure, of course.
But Calexico has a really big issue in, you know, the community not being involved in a lot of times, especially when it comes to voting. And I feel that one of the biggest reasons is because we have a lot of, you know, that transient community that comes and goes.
Border town has unique issues. Sure.
How do we get them involved? How do we make them see the importance of them, knowing what's going on in the community, knowing who they're voting into, city council, ID, the county? How do you, you know, make them see that? You know, you can take your ballot and put it in the mail and, you know, it's going to make a big difference in who's at the city, at the table.
I can't give you the answer in general because we're still working on and we refine. We have to change our ways all the time also. But I'm going to tell you that the most effective way at the end is that it comes from within them, that you find the trusted voice. Each pocket of people is a different community. Mm-hmm. There are many communities in Calexico, many communities in the valley, but Calexico seems to have many different pockets, more so than any other town. Mm-hmm. And they have different leaders within that, some that are natural leaders, some who are self-appointed leaders. Stay away from the self-appointed. Mm-hmm. Work with the ones who the people really do trust.
What do you mean by self-appointed?
Like, they say, oh, you know, yo hablo por este grupo without them even saying yes. Okay. Yeah, there's many of those that want to talk for people.
I think I've seen a couple of those.
Right. They really don't. La gente, they don't want to make a big fuss about it, so they just, déjalo, you know. Mm-hmm. But they don't listen. you need to really, it's hard, but work on those who are those really true, trusted person in those communities that people do believe in and will listen to them. Doesn't mean they're going to do what they want, you know, what you want them to tell them to do, but they will listen at least and be more engaged if those, if they are, you know, if those are the ones delivering the message. It's hard for an outsider to come in and tell people what's the best for them. We've learned that from trial and error. We can be a messenger to the community as a whole, and we can work in getting their trust by delivering services, delivering opportunities, and working with the true leadership of each small community. That's the only way. That's called respect. So we're giving them respect that, one, they know a little something. Some people come and try to tell them, you don't know anything. Yes, they do know something. Two, that we can work together without me wanting anything. People don't believe that. They always think somebody wants something. Yeah, ¿Qué quieres? ¿Por qué viene? Yeah. ¿Qué es su interés? Have you heard that before?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
All the time.
I think I've even said it myself.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And we do know people that they do have, you know, su interés and all that, right? They believe.
Yeah, and yeah, I mean, there's...
But we can't be so jaded that we don't engage anymore. Mm. So we need to find those trusted voices.
And again,
and
I think the biggest issue would be time. Like when, say you don't trust somebody, like you're like, oh, ¿a qué viene este? You know, what's his, ¿qué su interés? You, obviously, if you want to know if he's really doing it because he wants to do it for the good reason, you need to invest that time to get to trust them and know them. So a lot of people don't
that
have
that. That takes time.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of people don't have the time.
They don't have that, right? Yeah. They don't have it, and if they do have it, they're going to use it for something else or another issue.
Like a little side hustle or something.
I'm going to tell you, how many politicians do you know that only come when it's time for their election? I know some politicians, they friend me on Facebook. I'm older, so I use Facebook, right? So on Facebook, they friend me when it's election season. And once the election season is over that they were running for, I'm unfriended from them.
Yeah, happens to me too.
Oh, you see? That's exactly. That's a perfect example. Now, should I trust this person that they're really interested, or they're trying to use my network of people that do listen to me once in a while? A lot of people, they don't listen to me. I'm going to say they look to me for information, because I will give them information. I have a lot of information. Like I said, I never speak in public unless I'm well informed, because I don't want to say something that's going to come back to haunt me in a public arena if it's wrong. Or it's done in an ill-informed way, I think that hurts not just me, but it hurts the people I want to represent. So I always want to be well-informed. And I pass that on to anybody who wants. And I've been very successful with people. They ask me. A lot of times politicians have asked me so they can learn the other side of what they have no idea I'm talking about. And you know, that puts it into perspective what other people are saying. Now I understand. I never really lived that life, so now I understand it better. Oh, you really know that certain group of people. Yeah, I go there. I talk to them. They tell me, and I'm just passing on what they tell me. I didn't live it either, but I'm letting you know what they say.
From them, yeah.
From them.
From their mouth.
Yeah, from their mouths. And and it helps them. Not that they make the right decisions all the time, but I am a good source of information, because I think it's important to be well-informed. I know a lot of people that talk basically out of their ass, right?
Yeah, a lot of people.
And their preconceived ideas, they don't even look into the idea of what they're talking about. And they yell it out as truth, and it's not truth. There might be a part of truth that isn't the ultimate truth. There's a lot more to everything. The truth has many angles, as I tell everybody. And then there's that, what I call, some people don't understand it. Not everything is black and white. Yes or no, right and wrong. There's a gray area in between and a lot of things too. That's where we need to flesh out the gray areas. That's where the opportunities lie.
And we talk about, you know, that transient community here in Calexico. And you know, obviously affordable housing is a big issue, not only here, but in California. Do you think that, you know, if there was affordable housing, because I feel that for a lot of people that do this, crossing the border every night, it's gone to a point where they've done it so much as, you know, a lifestyle.
Sure.
And especially...
We are a suburb of Mexicali, Calexico, let's be honest.
Do you think that if they were offered some type of affordable housing that, you know, it would keep them here, or they would still prefer that? Because, I mean...
I think you'd have a small percentage that would take it, but I think more they would still prefer the lifestyle of Mexicali. Mm-hmm. What do you do in Calexico? compared to Mexicali.
Yeah. I mean, it's a different world.
It's a whole different, it's a metropolitan city with over a million residents, Los Compadres, and ahorita what is it going to be? Las Posadas everywhere, right?
There's people partying outside.
Partying outside, yeah, burning, I don't know why, rubber tires. The worst thing they do, the air quality during Christmas and New Year's is the worst here in the valley during the time. They're burning rubber tires. You know how many bad chemicals you're taking in? I don't understand why they burn tires.
Yeah, me neither. But yeah, you see it. you go crossing, you cross the border, you see people outside, you know, that's what they're doing.
But it's a lifestyle. Mm-hmm. But yeah, if they were to offer more, I'm telling you what, we've done a lot of political campaigns where you go door to door and we get the list of voters and you'll see like 8 to 9 people registered at one house, all with different last names. It's incredible. And they got the car parked almost to the door. Oh, man, that's one of my pet peeves. And you have to go around the car to knock on the door to talk to people, right? You seen that? Yeah. I don't understand that. But anyway, and I asked them, oh, no vive aquí, nomás usan esta dirección. Yeah, sure, to get their paperwork, to get their checks, to get their mail, to get their unemployment. They have to have an address over here. When we were doing vaccinations for farm workers in the morning with Dr. Wu, you know, they had a lot of those P.O. boxes as their address. Yeah, right? They rent a P.O. box because they get the checks or other mail through the work at the P.O. boxes, even though they don't live here in Calexico, but that's their address for the United States is that P.O. box. They use that, right? A true transient community. Yeah, it's really interesting. And you'll see it along the whole border. But Calexico,
you see that a lot in Brawley? Or is it just, do you think it's more here in Calexico?
More here, because the proximity to walk across and back is so much easier. A lot of people who have a car in Mexicali don't have a car here, right? So they work over here and they use the bus and over here, but they have a car over there and they're all over the place, right? And they go visit other parts in Mexico.
Yeah, for sure.
Or they can't have a car here, right? Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. So it's really interesting. So they keep their properties and it's really interesting. You know, it's good and it's bad, right? It's good and it's bad. But thank God we have a reliable workforce or else we'd be really in trouble. My children never didn't want to work in the fields, you know. Most young people, it's very hard work. Are they going to work in the fields for that type of pay? Mm-hmm. And those type of conditions, waking up real early in the morning, getting out there. And if it's cold, you got to work, you know, and you're tired. And the next thing you got to do it again.
I think a lot of people here in Calexico, you know, do it to their kids to kind of like teach them a lesson.
Yeah, a lesson.
And all right, you want to, you know, be messing around, go, I'm going to take you out to the fields with your tios or whatever.
Yeah.
And then come back and it's kind of like a scared trade kind of tactic.
Yeah, very good. Yeah. Nothing more than doing it yourself and feeling the pain and the cold and the frost and you feel disrespected when you do work like that. That's all I get.
Yeah. Sure.
And según they're taking out your social security and other taxes, well, you never shows up, right? Sometimes it never shows up anywhere that you work.
Yeah, for sure.
We laugh about it, but I'm saying it's a tragedy, but it happens, right?
Yeah. You mentioned Cesar Chavez a lot. It's something. Is he somebody that you look up to? Or
sure. Cesar Chavez. The movement at Cesar Chavez was happening as I was a young boy, and being a migrant family ourselves, we saw during that movement and then here in the valley. And I'm going to tell you one of the biggest incidences of why I do what I do was also the 1979 lettuce strike here in Imperial Valley when they killed Rufino Contreras, who was a farm worker from Mexicali in Calexico in the 1979 lettuce strike in February during that strike. And I was in high school, I was a freshman so I really believed in the American dream, you know, and justice for all. And it slapped me, even though I had seen all these other injustices, it slapped me in the face that here was a farm worker shot in the field right outside in between here, Calexico and Hopeville, where by three, they had three suspects that were hired by the ranchero to protect the fields. It was a tough strike, and they weren't supposed to have firearms, and yet they shot them. The investigation supposedly was botched, and they were let free, and no one was ever charged. So, knowing inside information, they do know ultimately who killed him, and they refused to prosecute based on the fact that who were the power brokers, rancheros, right? Mm-hmm. Who were the who were considered the troublemakers, Cesar Chavez and his farm workers, and who were they? Mexican field workers who had no power, very little education. The system was stacked against them. I've done some interviews with people. In fact, there's a book coming out, I hope, by Jimmy Durantes on it that his wife investigated. I've been anxiously waiting for it, but I interviewed a lot of people. I worked for United Farm Workers for a while. I took a leave of absence from the school to fulfill my dream of working for United Farm Workers. So that was a dream. So, and it pointed to everything we talk about. It's called And Justice for All, as my friend Denny Santillan always says at the end of every, when they do the
flag salute.
The salute. He goes, And Justice for All. And then you can hear him under his breath, who can afford it? So you look at U.S. justice system, those who have a lot have an opportunity to do more injustices than those who not have ways to defend themselves, right? If you think about it. It's a shame, right? We want to believe in the American dream, but that Rufino Contreras murder and lack of justice seeking by the justice system in Imperial County really shaped a lot of my ideas as well. It kind of shattered what I thought about this country.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think for something that I remember from elementary was like, oh, we're this melting pot of all these cultures.
For that. That was the theory.
Yeah.
You're going to assimilate and we're all going to be the same. Mm-hmm. Well, you can't. We're each a different flavor, as you would say, in that pot. We're all different ideas. Even within the same raza, mm-hmm. we're different, right? I'm not the same as my neighbor, you know, different ideas. And we need to respect that. One thing about the Rufino Contreras, when I taught Chicano studies, actually it started in U.S. history. Remember, I would interject Chicano history into it. I would do a march from El Hoyo to the cemetery where Rufino is.
Oh, he's here.
Where Rufino is buried.
He's in Calexico?
Because they did that in 79, Cesar Chavez, about 10,000. Even the governor of the time, Jerry Brown, came and walked. Artists, famous actors, musicians, and they came and did that walk. Very famous point of Calexico history. And a lot of my students, when I see them now, they, hey, remember when we did that Rufino Contreras march? Yeah, they really learned. And funny thing, we talk about how parents don't talk to their children that often about things. They would go, they would be interested, and they would go, and they would speak there. And their sons or daughters say, you know, Mr. Reyes, they never even mentioned this before in their lives to me. But that was their opportunity there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I said, we all need to dialogue more with each other, talk to each other, respect each other, and know why they feel the way they feel. Ah, tú no me entiendes, but we don't know why they don't understand me, right?
Yeah. And recently there's been, you know, some criticism towards Cesar Chavez about him not really liking immigrants or because there's, I think I saw a clip somewhere, somebody shared it. What are your thoughts on?
Well, in the context, if you hear it raw, it's going to come off that he just doesn't like illegal immigrants, period.
Mm.
But if you hear it all in the context, it's talking about using them, undocumented workers to break his, strikes.
Oh, okay.
So it was hurting his cause that he was doing.
Mm.
And of course, he's not going to like them using something to hurt. He was so focused on his farm worker and getting the most for his workers that using undocumented workers to break his strikes, therefore lose him losing power. Remember, people are obsessed by power. It's one thing you have to understand. It could be a little bit of power or a large amount of power.
Mm-hmm.
But they're obsessed by power. But losing the power of striking because of illegal immigrants, undocumented workers, sure it upset him. And yes, he struck out against undocumented workers being used to break his strikes because it was hurting his base of power in that and leverage that he had in those strikes he was using. In time, and you have to remember, in the farm worker community evolved from families like ours who were born here, great majorities who were families and we were born here and raised here and then they were farm workers. It evolved into an almost exclusive immigrant farm worker. I mean that almost 90% say are immigrants in some way or another.
Yeah.
Right? Some are documented, some are not. Many undocumented workers, obviously. So they also evolved an understanding that they needed to embrace the undocumented worker as well to make their movement stronger within the context of what was happening in the farms, that they were outwardly reaching out to undocumented to use them too, so they couldn't organize, so they couldn't strike. And they pushed for reform for immigrations. Remember the immigration reform in the 80s? They're the United Farm Workers are the ones that that pushed for that. La Rodino bill. Remember the Rodinos? That people that have been living here for years had a chance to get their micas and or citizenship. They were the ones leading that. So why? It evolved from that time, understanding that they need to embrace undocumented workers to make their movement so they could become part of the farm worker community as well in a positive way, not us against them, which farmers were doing. Some rancheros are smart business people, and they know the best way to conquer is to divide. Mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I was going to ask you.
So that Cesar Chavez in the 1968-70 grape strike is not the same Cesar Chavez of 87 that helped pass the Rodino legislation for undocumented workers. We all change. If they were to have clips of me when I was younger, they'd say, who the heck is that? That's not Eric. He doesn't care about nobody, right?
So you think that from right now till, I don't know, 10 years from now, you think you'll change to maybe change your mind to maybe run for government? Or is it something that...
Oh, you know, I'm going to say now that I'm older and it's the worst time to run is when you get old. it could be an option.
Because before we recorded, you were talking that you wouldn't...
No, I would not. Before I had made up... I decided to be... You see what happens in Imperial County, especially worse when I was younger. Anybody who was really progressive, liberal... I'm not that liberal, but I'm more liberal than most people here in Imperial County at that time, especially... and would say things against the status quo and establishment. And I'm talking about in those days, the white power, dominance of in political office of Imperial County. You were seen as someone negative, radical, and someone that they would try to eliminate. So they would come up with, things to make sure you would look bad. A lot of people don't like me, that ni modo. I'm not gonna cry over it. I don't lose sleep over it. But I said what I had to say, and that's why I made that decision. I'm not gonna run because I'm not gonna be held back by saying something that's gonna hurt me when I run later. Right? So now that I'm a lot older, I could do it.
Yeah.
I'm not gonna say no. How's that? But there's no way I would have run before, and I was really radical and really much more outspoken before. I've kind of mellowed now, and I do more research. Like I told you, I really won't speak unless I know what I'm talking about. Before, I would say some outrageous things sometimes just to get that attention of an issue that I wanted raised. And that's the tactic I had to have at that time. Now it's changing slowly. And unfortunately, we've elected more Mexicanos, Mexican-Americans, which is a goal. Not that much difference has been made. There's still a stranglehold in power. Certain groups and certain people still hold most of the power here in Imperial County. And that's what we ultimately want to change.
Mm-hmm.
And it's intermixed now. And yet what drives people? Profit, right?
Yeah.
Profiteering and power, having power. And I think if they shared profits and shared power more with the community, we'd be much better off.
I think that's one thing that scares me about running is power. Even though, you know, as someone that's looking, you know, from the outside, I'm like, well, in reality, you really don't have a power. I mean, you're just one vote in reality.
Mm-hmm.
But if there's a group of people who owns two votes,
yeah,
three votes,
yeah,
you know.
And that's how unfortunately, that's how a lot of the councils and supervisors and other district, school districts, that's how they work. They count to three. Instead of counting to 50,000 who they represent. Say you live in Calexico, you're about 44,000, mm-hmm. right? Right now you have a council, you know, and they're not going to like it, but they're counting to three most of the time.
Yeah.
Three votes versus two, right?
Mm-hmm.
So are they truly representing all 43,000? Do those three council really take into account every single thing other Calexicans are also thinking about, you know, it'd be very difficult because they basically shut out the other two from even discussing it. The other day, Gloria Romo and Raul Ureña walked out of a meeting I saw because they brought up the issue of discussing the health and COVID, and they did not even want to discuss it, that it was too political. Well, you're a city council. It is political, and it was important though. So are you really taking into account all 44,000 people of Calexico if you're not allowing a discussion on something that is important to the whole community? And my criticism is they should have allowed the discussion. If they wanted to not do anything, they have that power. They had 3 votes. They obviously were not in favor of whatever they were going to bring up. But why not have a public discussion? Discussion is the best thing you can have. And then if you vote it down, which is their perfect right, go ahead and vote it down. But not allowing the discussion, though, was a disservice to the community. Some people who look, maybe that's where they get their information. I don't know. People get their information from different areas, right? Mm-hmm. Some go to city council and thinking that's, esto gente me representan lo mejor.
Yeah.
Ellos me van a decir lo que yo quiero escuchar. They might be just looking for information. By not having a discussion, they're not allowing information to be processed and given out to
people. Yeah, for sure. Well, we're at an hour and 20-some.
Dang.
To be honest, I was looking at the time. I was like, man, we're already this much in. We can probably have another conversation some other day.
Oh, yeah.
Anytime. Because, I really wanted to delve into, you know, you growing up here in the Valley. Because
I gave you good information.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. It was a really fun and interesting conversation.
And just tell you that Calexico has been a godsend to me. Coming from Brawley and those racial and inter-raza divisions, and coming to a dominant Mexican community like Calexico was a safe haven for me in the way I thought and my issues that I had, right? So I felt very comfortable here. The students, fantastic. I loved all of them, you know. I loved them so much. And then my coworkers, I had issues with some of the Anglo teachers, I'm not going to lie, but they had issues with me. Again, because I was not your traditional teacher, where I would bring some of my political views and agenda into the classroom. And they all do. Okay,
yeah, but
mine was not mainstream, so therefore they had issues with it. But that's okay. I think we learned to survive. But what I did get the most, besides the school and the great students and staff that worked there, the personal relationships I've made through the years, but what I liked about Calexico was those pockets of communities, how they did have leaderships and they were active in pushing their agendas. And I learned how you have to politic at all points of your life. Calexico really taught me that a lot. And I met great people, you know, some who have passed, Nene Torres and all those guys. They were big into politics, but they were always negotiating and working instead of trying to shove that thing down people's throats. And that's how you get things done. So I really appreciate that.
Yeah. Well.
And then being raza, it was great, you know.
Well, thank you for sharing, you know, all these things with us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me.
I don't know.
Ever since that BSN interview, everybody wants to interview me. I'm still the same guy from 30 years ago. He just rediscovered me, I told him.
Yeah, for sure. And you know what? I think for me that one time was, I really, you know, I knew who you were because you were a teacher when I was in high school. Mm-hmm. And I've seen you on social media and all these things. But, you know, I was in the booth and I was listening to everything you were saying. Uh-huh. And sometimes, like, I don't... you know, I know the people here in the county and because I hear the names, but I don't really don't.
Yeah, and put a face to it.
Or you know, or like
what
I said,
the work they've done. Mm-hmm. Sure.
So like I got to listen to what you were saying. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, doing this VSN thing was really taught me a lot about the Valley, especially these car rides with John and Vic were really... you know, really, really, really interesting. You know, the experience they have about, you know, living in the Imperial Valley.
Oh yeah.
Victor went out to the south to play baseball. He had a lot of good experiences down there. So it's like, you know, these stories that they have, and then, you know, you being somebody that they trusted and trust them. It's like, you know,
relationships are important.
I kind of, you know, wanted to see, you know, yeah. wanted to learn more about you.
Oh, great. Thanks.
And when I asked you, you were like,
what do you want to talk to me for? I'm nobody important, you know?
And it's funny because when I started this, that's the answer I got from a lot of people. Mm. Who are you? Why do you want to talk to me?
I knew who you were. I didn't know why you wanted to talk to me. I'm saying.
And yeah, it was interesting having to go back and kind of like, because I normally don't give, you know, the questions. And I didn't really give you questions. I told like, I want to learn about it. But, you know, thank you for accepting my invitation.
No, of course, anytime.
And like I said, maybe we come back again some other day and talk about more about, you know, the committees. Because we didn't really talk too much about them because we were talking about all these things.
Yeah, definitely. I can talk to you about a lot of initiatives I have worked on, things that are in place now that... not just me, but others that we worked on. Mm. That see, people get benefits from the work we do. That's our goal. They don't even know it's us who had it put into place. Mm-hmm. But that's what we believe in. You know, we have to be at these policy making meetings so they put in policy that helps the people that we work with. Mm-hmm. And people aren't engaged. Well, we have to be their voice. Like I told you, that's what we try to do.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. Is there anything that you want to add before we...
No, when I come back. You asked me about Cesar Chavez. I'm going to tell you that he is an example of his model of si se puede, only an eighth grade education. Yet at one point, he was the most well-known Mexican-American ever, right? Mm. Think of who didn't know Cesar Chavez at the height of his... He brought an industry that is very powerful, the ag industry, almost to its knees. But what he did was he created a legacy of people, the children and the legislators afterwards, to make sure that those issues that he brought are still continued and made into laws. Now we have pesticide laws. We have, all kinds of issues, environmental exposure laws that before farm workers were exposed to and they were dying from cancer and so on, that they still do. But I'm saying it's much better and much more regulated. Mm-hmm. And that's his legacy. And yes, I do respect him. And I'm part of that movement and always will be.
Yeah, for sure. All right, Eric. Well, thank you so much for speaking to us and sharing with us. All right, guys. Well, hope you guys have a nice Saturday. Stay safe. And hit that subscribe button if you haven't yet. And we'll see you in the next one. Peace.